Pharma lobbyists locking in one of the biggest corporate rip-off schemes in history. Stay tuned.
Everybody, this is Frank Knuckles from the legendary Roots Crew, and you're listening to right now, We at Radio. Stay tuned, stay locked.
May 25th, 2016, and it's time for the Education Town Hall on We Act Radio. We're coming to you live from the heart of historic Anacostia, here in Southeast Ward 8, Washington, D.C., down the street from the Big Chair. I first want to begin by thanking the Creator for this day and the opportunity to present to you the latest installment of the Education Town Hall. This is your humble servant and host, Thomas Byrd. But before getting started with the show, I want to first thank those who have supported this show financially. I want to thank DC Voice, the 21st Century School Fund, the Senior High Alliance of Parents, Principals, and Educators, also known as SHAPE, which they celebrated their 18th year this past week. I want to thank the Washington section of the National Council of Negro Women. I want to thank the Ward 5 Council on Education. I want to thank Deborah Robinson, and I want to thank all the anonymous donors and sponsors who have contributed to the show. And I want to thank our major sponsor, the Washington Teachers Union, under the leadership of Elizabeth Liz Davis. They had a wonderful forum this past Saturday here in D.C. And folks, if you or your organization believes that this is an important platform to give everyone access to the public square, then help us ensure that it remains available by offering your financial support. So please contact me at thomas.byrd@yahoo.com. That's thomas.byrd@yahoo.com. thomas.byrd@yahoo.com. We would greatly appreciate your support. All right, I think we're going to have a great show in store for you today, although I always say that every week, but I believe it's true because this is Bus Thursday. And if you're tuning into the show for the first time, you should know that every fourth Thursday of the month, we have Bus Thursday. And you ask, what is Bus Thursday? Bus is a collaboration between us, the Education Town Hall, and our national partners, Badass Teachers Association, United Opt Out, Save Our Schools, BUS, Bus Thursday. And we're always glad to have Bus Thursday roll around because it's a wonderful Thursday to share information, not only here in the region, but nationally. So anyway, we're going to get to the bus program momentarily because we're going to have Julian Hillig, who's a MPE board member. And then we're going to be later joined by a friend of the show, Rosalie Friend of Save Our Schools. But before getting into all of that, I'm going to now swing over to our feature reporter, Virginia Spatz, for her weekly feature report. Good morning, Virginia, and take it away.
Good morning, Thomas. Thanks. On Tuesday, protesters disrupted the Los Angeles Unified School District's Committee of the Whole meeting with demands concerning policing in schools and use of military surplus equipment. Los Angeles is among 23 school systems and 102 colleges around the country which had obtained military equipment, including grenade launchers, armored vehicles, rifles, and automatic weapons under the Department of Defense's 1033 program. Tuesday's protest, led by the Labor Community Strategy Center, followed 18 months of activism asking for return of the military equipment, which LAUSD says has already happened, proof of this action, and a public inventory of existing weapons. The group is also asking for a public apology for the school system arming against its students and reduction in school police force and weapons of all kinds. Back in 2014, LA's school police force reevaluated its military weapons. The chief determined that 40-millimeter less lethal weapons, otherwise known as grenade launchers, were, quote, not essential life-saving items within the scope, duties, and mission of the Los Angeles School Police Department. They returned them to the DOD. Rifles and a mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, however, were declared life-saving items and kept until very recently. In an early February letter, the chief says that all equipment obtained through the DOD's 1033 program has been returned. I was not able to determine how many of the other school districts and colleges still have DOD gear and weapons. Meanwhile, at least one Texas university is warning faculty to avoid sensitive topics in their classes this coming fall when a new state law allowing students to carry guns on campus goes into effect. Listeners who do not already know about the weaponry legally present at all levels of education in this country, please visit our website for more on these stories and the Students Ain't Bulletproof efforts. In closing, an action request from Teaching for Change for these final days of Black History Month. The Education Town Hall reported earlier this year on Scholastic Books publication and then withdrawal of A Birthday Cake for George Washington, a happy fictionalization of enslaved people serving the first U.S. president. Teaching for Change, the locally based national group which helped force Scholastic to withdraw the book, continues to work on the wider picture regarding diversity and truth in publishing. Their Step Up Scholastic campaign urges everyone to review the current Scholastic catalog and critique its offerings. The aim is to help one of the largest publishers of children's books realize the limitations of its catalog and expand its boundaries. The action is organized by Teaching for Change, American Indians in Children's Literature, and Ferguson Response Network. You'll find a link to Scholastic's catalog and this action on educationtownhall.org later today. This is Virginia Spatz reporting for the Education Town Hall on WEACT Radio, powered by Ethical Electric.
All right, Virginia, thank you so much for that feature report. I want to now swing over to our guest. He's new to the show, and we welcome him taking time out of his busy schedule to join us here on the Education Town Hall. He is a professor, a blogger, on-air education contributor, both radio and print, and so many other things. We're glad to have you, Dr. Julian Helig, and I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly.
It's Helig, but I've been called much worse even today, so no problem.
Helig. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Glad to be here.
And I want to note that you're a member of NPE. Is that correct?
Sure. So I'm actually a founding board member of the Network for Public Education. For those of you that are familiar with Diane Ravitch's work, former Assistant Secretary of Education, she called me about 4 years ago and said, I'd like to invite you to my home in Brooklyn. And so I was sitting on the couch in Diane Ravitch's home, and she said, I'd like to start a new nonprofit on behalf of K-12 community-based education. So she and Anthony Cody invited me to be one of the governing board members several years ago.
Okay, and I think Diane is still the president, is that correct?
She is. She is still the president. She's heavily involved in everything we do, and she's our leader.
And so why don't you just give us a brief overview of the mission of the Network for Public Education?
Sure. And I think the mission's probably very similar to your radio program. I was listening to some of the supporters of your program, and I didn't hear Gates Foundation. I didn't hear Broad Foundation. I didn't hear the millionaires and the billionaires. When I was listening to the supporters of your organization, it's a community-based approach to this education town hall. And that's really what the Network for Public Education is. It's a community-based approach to education reform. We seek to network organizations, some of the very organizations that the Bus Network, United Opt Out, the BAT. These are all folks that are members of our organization, and we seek to be sort of an umbrella organization that brings together all of these different groups on behalf of community-based reform in opposition to this corporate-style education reform that's out there, the testing, the standards, the top-down private control and privatization and corporatization of education.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Here on the Education Town Hall and this radio station, We Act Radio, we believe in telling truth and speaking back to power and getting the message out that we think needs to be heard by the masses to provoke this conversation, but ultimately to lead to action. So our motto here is do something. And so we want to talk about it, but we ultimately want to do something about it. And so that's what we're trying to progress this conversation down the road to action.
That's right. That's exactly right. And the groups that represent the Bus radio show, they're all doing that. They're not just talking about it. They're being about it. Whether it be the United Opt Out folks, where 20% of folks in New York opted out of the test, whether it be SOS, which I know is planning a big march coming up, or the Network for Public Education, we're going to be about it. We're going to be talking about what's happening to the black kids in New Orleans. We're going to be talking about the things that John King did in New York that are problematic. So we're definitely going to be about it too.
Fantastic. I want to get into one of the things you're here to talk about, and that is the Network for Public Education report card. And then we'll talk a little bit about the conference. What is the report card? What is that all about? And tell us a little bit about that.
So one of the education reformers, the corporate reformers' tools over the past couple of years is to release these report cards. And essentially what they do is they give grades to different states on education. And I wrote about this in the Progressive magazine a few days ago. And really what most of these report cards do is they focus on ideology. And so they reward, for example, Students First, which is Michelle Rhee's outfit or former outfit, reward states for things like parent trigger, which is where parents can vote to turn over a school to a corporation, take the building, take the property, the real estate, and turn it over to a corporation. And so they reward states for these types of, private control and privatization. And they also use test scores to compare states. So we thought about, I told the story in the Progressive magazine about in high school when someone baked me some cookies. But they handed the cookies to me, but then pulled them right back and said, well, you can't actually have these cookies because I didn't put all the right ingredients. I forgot the sugar in these cookies. And so I think a lot of report cards are just like that. They don't think about the actual ingredients that matter for public education. So what we wanted to do is put together a report card that considered the ingredients that are important, the research-based, the empirically-based ingredients that we know matter for a high-quality education for children, instead of just measuring the outcomes, comparing test scores state to state. Now, we were hard graders, I'm going to be honest with you, because really our nation has abdicated its responsibility to public education because many of the policymakers in our nation, many of the politicians, are really infatuated with these private control and privatization schemes, whether it be vouchers, charter schools, the privatization of testing, et cetera, et cetera. And so we, you know, no state received higher than a C. But I think it's really a wake-up call to policymakers and to other education stakeholders to say that we need to be thinking about the ingredients in the cookies instead of just comparing the sizes of the cookies.
You know, I want to ask you, you just made a point that, you know, we've made here before and we've heard made about policymakers wanting to go down that road towards privatization. What are your thoughts about that? Why do you think that they're so inclined to do that?
Well, I think there's actually a really interesting coalition. And you even see this with civil rights groups in D.C. I spent a lot of time in D.C. What you see is folks that are really generally interested. They understand that the African-American kids, Latino kids, poor white kids, that they've received a uneven education historically. So they're really interested in charter schools and vouchers because they've been sold this bill of goods that it's about civil rights. But most of these policies, testing, charter schools, vouchers, they were originally created for discriminatory purposes. So vouchers created by Milton Friedman, who ended up winning the Nobel Prize in the 1970s, he said at the time that vouchers would allow us to create segregated schools and keep segregated schools. Testing was created about 100 years ago to segment society, to sort society, and that's what tests do. They sort society. This idea that somehow we will close an achievement gap by testing kids more and more and more is silly. That's not why tests were created. They were created for discriminatory purposes. And so a lot of these policies were created for discriminatory means. Why would they function differently in these times? They've just been reframed as civil rights, even though they are were created as discriminatory. But there are other people that just believe that we should privatize public services, that we should be able to use markets and make money off of different things that government does. And so you have this sort of motley alliance between people that think that these policies are about civil rights, which, of course, they're not. They were created for discriminatory purposes, and folks that we call them neoliberals, that's the term for them, folks that want to privatize schools. And you see places like Chile, where every kid has a voucher in the country of Chile. The reason why the dictator Pinochet created that voucher system was because he didn't want government to pay for education. Mm. He wanted it to be privately provisioned. And so that's the tension that you have. People that really truly believe in civil rights have allied themselves with privatizers.
You know, that makes absolutely no sense to me because I still can't see the correlation between civil rights and getting an education in terms of how they frame it. Because to me, and we talked about this recently here on the show, if you look at all the major urban centers in this country, yep, a lot of them are governed and run by African Americans. So, sure, you know, I mean, I'm still trying to understand that, you know, this civil rights piece, you know, that hasn't really formulated yep, in my mind. How could this be? I could see, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, but nowadays, yep, that doesn't jive with me. And I know my feature reporter, Virginia, wants to jump in, but I'll give you a chance to respond and then Virginia.
Sure, I'll make a quick one. So really what this is about is folks that believe in top-down private control and privatization. You see this with testing. You see this with charter schools. You see this with vouchers. It's the common denominator, the common theme of what many folks have sort of bought in. And so part of the challenge is that we have just been saying no to charters, no to vouchers, no to testing. We haven't done a good job at talking about what the alternative vision is for the next 10 years of education. And that alternative vision, you see hints of it in ESSA, which is a community-based approach, a democratically-based approach. There are community-based democratic alternatives to top-down privatized assessment. There's community-based alternatives to charter schools. There's community-based alternatives to each of the things that the private control and privatization reformers want, and that includes John King. Unfortunately, it has included Barack Obama and Arne Duncan. It includes these millionaire and billionaire foundations. They are pushing for private control and privatization. We have to talk about the community-based, democratically controlled alternatives for testing, for accountability, et cetera. We've got to do a better job of that.
Virginia?
Well, I wanted to say that I thought our guest had, in a way, already addressed the question you were talking about by explaining to us that the narrative is being controlled by people who want to privatize schools. So they're trying to convince the general public that low test scores is a civil rights issue, that, right. you know, we are failing our black children, and so you have to do X, Y, and Z, which actually involves privatizing. And so I just wanted to touch on some of the points that actually you do grade in the report card, integrated schools and small class sizes, that kind of thing, because in other report cards, D.C. is getting an A and a B because we have high charter schools and you know, they fault us because we do actually have some regulations on homeschooling, but you know, we're kind of a privatizer's heaven. So could you speak a little about what you did measure?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, just talking about the ingredients. So, for example, you won't see in the Fordham Foundations or ALEC, American Legislative Executive Council, or Students First, measures of poverty, measures of inequality. That's one of the things that we included. Class size reduction. We know, for example, one of the biggest bangs for your buck in the research literature is class size reduction. The reason why policymakers don't really like class size reduction is because it's expensive. Mm-hmm. The thing is, we'll throw money at the education of rich folks. I mean, this, in any city you can think about, all you got to think about is the really nice suburbs in Virginia, for example, or on the other side of the tracks or outside of 8 Mile in Detroit. We know where the inequality lies and who goes to what kinds of schools, right? So that's the conversation that folks don't want to have. They don't want to have the conversation about the fact that in every city, inequality is laid bare. What they want us to be talking about is the privatizer's heaven. They want us to be talking about New Orleans. They want us to be talking about D.C. They want us to be talking about Chicago. But the thing is that we know the research-based reforms that make a difference. And so that's what we were trying to do in this report, is put out there in the public space what the gold standards are. We know inequality is an issue, so we measured that. We know class size has a big impact, so we measured that. We know that other community-based approaches to education reform matter. So what we really tried to do here is put out into the public space what we know from the research literature and experiences of communities matter, instead of focusing people on all these privatization and private control variables.
And, go ahead, Virginia.
Well, and I wanted to ask, I know you've had a little time to get responses from the general public and from other researchers. Has the response been positive? Do people get the message, or are they still on, you know, you should get an A if you follow this policy?
Well, I mean, there are the true believers in private control and privatization. And on Twitter, you know, there's a lot of people that will engage you. You know, I was talking about people call me much worse. That happens on Twitter. I'm at Professor JVH if you're a Twitter kind of person. And so, you know, I think that a lot of these things take, you know, need momentum. So you have to get them to the right people. I'm also the education chair for the state conference of the California NAACP. So I made folks aware of this, you know, at the state level here in California about how we're performing. We have an education chair in the California NAACP, a Facebook page that's a secret group that I shared that. We share it with policymakers in Texas and California and other places. So, you know, these things require momentum. And so, you know, read the report. Check it out. Network for Public Education report card. Google that. And then send it to your legislator. Send it to your state representative. Send it to your state senator. Send it to your state legislator. Send it to the foundations in your local communities. You're going to have to help us with this, because we don't have the millions of dollars at the Broads and the Gates, these sorts of foundations. We're really a community-based organization, and we have to build momentum. We have to build our groundswell from community-based groups. And so check out the report, and please send it to folks. We had a big release at the National Press Club in D.C., so we, of course, did that side, and you could have read about it in the Washington Post. I wrote about it in the Progressive Magazine, and we have a few other pieces coming out in national you know, publications. But really, our organization really believes that we have people power. We can't compete with the millions of dollars that folks are putting behind the corporate side of education reform. So we lean on you, the people listening to this radio program, to check out this report card and give it to everyone you can think of.
You know, that's a wonderful approach, because we've got to change the narrative. We don't have the money to compete, but we got to change the narrative on the ground, community by community, and let this percolate up. And I think we can be successful.
That's right.
We've got a few minutes left, about 6 minutes, and I know I want to get to a couple of other things. I want you to talk about your upcoming conference in North Carolina in April. And then I want to just get your thoughts on our new Secretary of Education, John King. But why don't you start with the conference?
Oh, yeah, the conference. So the Network for Public Education has a national conference each year, and we bring together activists, parents, educators. This year it's going to be in Raleigh. Now, the reason why I, as a board director, voted for in Raleigh, and this isn't the official party line on why, well, because we know North Carolina is a battleground. You know, Barack Obama won that state in the past. It's a battleground. The second reason I voted for North Carolina is because North Carolina was, for a very long time, a shining beacon of education. But recently, the politicians in that state have rolled back teacher quality and a variety of other things.
They've mucked it up.
If it ain't broke, fix it. So, so there's that. And then, thirdly, the NAACP, Reverend Barber, Moral Mondays, is going to be our keynote speaker. And I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to that. So he is someone that I really admire. He is one of our civil rights leaders. So I think it'll be fantastic. And there'll be, you know, I will be there and Dan Ravitch will be there and all sorts of other folks that are in this fight linked arm to arm with the communities to press back against private control and privatization. So if you are looking for a conference, I know Raleigh is not Honolulu, but... But I will tell you, this is going to be an incredible conference, April the 16th and 17th. I look forward to meeting you there.
How do folks go about registering or getting there or participating?
Just go to Google, and if you type in Network for Public Education Conference Raleigh, it'll be the first link on Google. I checked that before I came on the call. And then you wanted to talk a little bit about John King. So John King is a contemporary of mine. I'm 40 years old. I think no one's talking about this, but John King is probably going to be the youngest Secretary of Education ever at 40. Mm. Now, if you are looking for someone who is gung-ho for charters and high-stakes testing, then you have found your man.
Mm-hmm. Are you serious?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. You have found your man because this is the man that, because the Common Core, he was a big proponent of the Common Core. The Common Core is all about testing. No matter what folks say about critical thinking, et cetera, when you look at the people who were in the room when Common Core was designed, and I talked about this on my blog, Cloaking Inequity. So, quick plug, Cloaking Inequity is my blog, read by nearly a million people in 200 countries, Cloaking Inequity. I talked about Common Core on the blog, and one of my students researched who was in the room. Half of the people in the room when Common Core was first talked about and designed were from the testing companies. And so Common Core is, don't be fooled, Common Core is all about the testing because, you know, if you're a kid and you don't pass the test, what do you have to do? You got to take the test again. And guess what happens when you have to take the test again? The testing company makes more money. Right. And so this is the thing is that the Common Core in New York, the biggest proponent probably was John King. Now, John King comes out of charter schools. If you look at his bio, he has been affiliated with all these different charter school organizations. So, you know, and the problem with Barack Obama is really the Republicans should accuse, and I like many things that Barack Obama has done. So please don't take this criticism as...
I'm sure I'm going to join you in that criticism. Go ahead.
But the thing is Barack Obama plagiarized George H.W. Bush's education platform. And I wrote about this on Cloaking Inequity. If you go back and look at George H.W. Bush's education platform from the 1990s, you will see Barack Obama's education policy. So if I was a Republican, I would be saying to Barack Obama, please stop plagiarizing our educational platform, because the things that Arne Duncan has done over the last 8 years look almost exactly like what Bush wanted 20 years ago. And so, on this issue, John King is the mirror image of what Barack Obama hired in Arne Duncan.
Mm-hmm.
Hardcore charters, hardcore testing, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that, you know, you're going to get more of the same with John King, unfortunately. I wish that Obama had really been about change and been more progressive on education policy. It's my biggest regret. I was on Barack Obama's education policy committee in the 2008 campaign, it's been my biggest regret about the last 8 years is that Barack Obama has just been bamboozled on education policy by the private control and privatizing.
Well, let me because we got less than a minute left, and so I just want to get a brief comment because you just said that, you know, it's going to be intensified in terms of John King being education secretary. But ESSA, doesn't that attempt to kind of roll back the power of the Secretary of Education?
Yeah, I mean, it does. So one of the cool things, one of the interesting things about ESSA is that it allows for states to rethink their accountability systems and have a more local community-based approach. Like California has had a local accountability program for 3 years now, and it allows for strategic approaches derived from the community level. So that is true. Now, you know, ESSA has something for everyone to hate in it. So I'm not going to tell you that I love ESSA. But on the accountability piece, they did try to ameliorate the impact of the Secretary of Education in that bill, and it does give states more flexibility. Now, what a lot of people aren't talking about, you know, is most of the stuff in ESSA doesn't go until 2017. But whoever becomes the next president, if ESSA goes sideways, every president gets the opportunity to reauthorize the ESEA, which is the Elementary Secondary Education Act. Mm-hmm. And so this was the latest reauthorization. So if ESSA is really terrible, next president could reauthorize it right away.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It just took Obama 8 years to do it.
Yeah. All right. There was so much. I wish we had some more time, but we've reached the bottom of the hour. But you're not going anywhere because you're going to be joined in the second half of the show by Rosalie, friend of Save Our Schools, and we're going to continue our conversation. Okay. And so, folks, we are so glad that you're tuned into the show today because we realize you have options. And so I guarantee if you stay with us, we will be right back.
Bullock, and I'm a student at Ballou Senior High School.
My name is Wallace Bright, and I'm a student at Ballou Senior High School.
My name is Victoria Harper, and I'm a student at Ballou Senior High School.
My name is James Hill, and I'm a student at Ballou Senior High School.
We've been talking with our peers across the District of Columbia, and we discovered that a lot of them are talking about how they believe that we are not being provided the high-quality education that we know we need and quite frankly deserve.
They are talking about students in other jurisdictions who are, for the most part, learning and being supported in modern facilities and have access to 21st century technology.
We're hearing them say that there are actually three public school systems in the district, DCPS West, DCPS East of the River, and public charter schools.
They are saying things like, we have been subjected to too many experimental models, unproven educational fads, and countless changes in philosophy and direction.
Some students are talking about how they feel that some of those in charge of our education system talk the good talk about reform and use all the other buzzwords, but at the end of the day, don't really give a damn about academic achievement for all.
Worst of all, everyone is talking about how we don't even have any voice in the public discourse around the direction of our education system.
Until now, because we all listen and share our views on the Education Town Hall, we are thankful that the host, Thomas Bird, believes that we should have access as well as a megaphone to talk back to the powers that be in the district and in halls of Congress. Join Thomas Bird every Thursday at 11 a.m. for the Education Town Hall, 1480 a.m. Listen live online at weacradio.com.
Hi, I'm Denise Rolark Barnes, publisher of the Washington Informer newspaper, and you've asked whether I think a show on education is a good idea for the District of Columbia, and I would give an unequivocal yes, it is. Information is power, we always know that, but information about education, resources, the politics, the finances, the what our young people could and should be achieving and what should be taught in the classroom is an exceptional you can't talk enough about it. Let me just say that. And I'm so glad that you are having the show. Continue to do the good work that you're doing. And folks out there, you just keep listening. If there's something you don't hear on the show, I'm sure that the folks here would love to hear from you and make sure it's a topic for an upcoming show. So keep on listening.
Mm-hmm. All right. We are now back live. Thank you so much for being here with us today on the Education Town Hall here on We Act Radio. Before getting bringing in Rosalie Friend and resuming our conversation with Julian Heilig.
Heilig.
I knew I was going to mess that up. I apologize, sir. I first want to share with the listeners here locally in the D.C. area. There's a play that's going to be tonight, February the 25th, at 7:30 p.m. And tomorrow, February 26th at 7:30 p.m. at the Arc Theater here in the District of Columbia, which is located on Mississippi Avenue. You can go to thearcdc.org and click on to buy tickets and get further information about it. But it's called Black Angels Over Tuskegee. It's an important piece. I think that you would get much enlightenment and enjoyment out of this play. So, folks, here in the District of Columbia and local area, Black Angels Over Tuskegee at the Arc here on Mississippi Avenue. All righty. It sounds like I hear Rosalie on the phone.
Here I am.
Okay, great. All right. I just want to circle back because we were talking offline here. I'll just call you Julian. That way I know I won't mess up your last name, if you don't mind. my engineer here, Ron Pinchback, suggested that I ask you about current politics, which we're looking as if the Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee, and if by chance this country goes completely nuts and elects him as president, what would an education system look like? I told Ron, who could describe chaos? But I'm gonna, you know, you're an academic, yeah. You know, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of weigh in on that.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, I was asked to write a column for Education Votes about a month ago, and so I actually watched a Republican debate, and they actually did not mention education, but maybe once. So, and it was actually Marco Rubio who mentioned education. So then I went to Marco Rubio's website because the welders comment. Remember where he said that welders make more than philosophy majors?
Uh-huh.
Which is actually false. Philosophy majors actually make more than welders. So I actually went to his education platform online to take a look at, well, what are the Republicans thinking on education right now? And I went through and I analyzed. And basically most of the information that they're putting out there, the data was false when you looked a little carefully, like when you fact-check it. So that's a good question. You know, Donald Trump hasn't, in any of the Republican debates that I've watched, talked about education. Not at all. But I don't think that, you know, Trump is alone in that. The Democrats have been pretty quiet on education, too. I know Hillary at one point said that many charter schools don't serve all kids. And then she took a lot of heat from the education, quote, reformers, and she had to walk back that statement. I wish she would have said many instead of most, but it was very progressive of her to say that. Now, Bernie, you know, talks a lot about free college, which I think, you know, I'm a big supporter of. If we can spend, you know, all the money that we spend, the billions on unending war, I think we can find the money to educate every child and give them free community college in the United States. So really I'm going to be straight with you. I think Democrats and the Republicans have been really, really quiet on what they would do on education. Now, what folks will say is, well, look at their, you know, look at their track records. But I think that, you know, talking about Hillary Clinton and what she supported in the 1990s, I think a lot of people have evolved since then. I mean, the crime bill was written by Joe Biden. The one that everybody's critiquing Hillary about, and Bernie voted for it. So I think it still remains to be seen. I'm going to be straight with you. We have worked with the campaigns behind the scenes, just talking to them about different ideas, but I don't know what's going to happen. I do know that Trump is essentially a fascist. So I don't know what fascist education policy looks like. But we'll see if he's elected, but I surely hope for our country and the world he's not.
Wow, that's interesting. I want to now swing over to Rosalie, Friend, who is a longtime friend of this show and coming to us from New York. And so we wanted to get an update because Denisha Jones, who's a regular as well, she's at the United Opt-Out, heading for to the United Opt-Out Conference for this weekend. But Rosalie, thank you for joining us today. How have you been doing?
I'm fine. I don't leave for the United Opt-Out Conference until tomorrow.
Oh, so you're going tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay. So
I'm not going to make it to North Carolina for the NPE, which I had hoped to attend.
Oh, okay. That's unfortunate. You know, I'm gonna have to try to make every effort myself to get down there. I'm very interested in what is going to take place there. And so, but Rosalie, you're joining us today to give us some important updates on New York.
Yes, and I'm going to step back and start with how we got into the situation, and you will notice the name John King mm-hmm. coming up quite a bit. Very interesting gentleman. So essentially, when you look back, our policies in New York State are set by a board of regents that's appointed by the state legislature. And since 2009, the chancellor of our board of regents has been Merrill Tisch, a wealthy woman with close ties to the corporate education reform movement that Dr. Heilig spoke of. While earning a doctorate in ed leadership at Columbia Teachers College, she and John King became friends. And they share a strong commitment to this corporate education reform agenda. He was appointed the commissioner in 2011. The commissioner, that's the head of the State Department of Education. And according to the New York Times, the two of them put the state on a tight timeline to implement data-driven teacher evaluations, to create computer systems to track student progress, and to toughen curricular standards and open more charter schools. And in pursuing that, one of the things they did in 2013 in February, they announced that the statewide exams for grades 3 to 8 in English, language, arts, and math would be more rigorous. They're supposed to be linked to the Common Core standards to assure college and career readiness. And what they did was to change the cut score, the passing score, so that only 30% of the children would get a passing score. In New York State, children are rated 1, 2, 3, or 4. Only 30% of the children would get a 3 or 4 proficient.
Wow.
That means that 70% of the kids are ranked as not proficient. Of course, psych professional standards, I'm an educational psychologist, it's completely against the standards to set the scores after the kids have taken the test. And if you're using this data-driven evaluation, which doesn't take into account whether the tests are accurate or valid, then you get a result that shows that most of the teachers and the schools are failing because you've set the score such that 70% will fail.
Let me interrupt you for a second. I want to give Dr. Heilig an opportunity to opine on what you just said.
Right. Well, I think what she said is that, and what I've written about, is that accountability and testing is arbitrary and political. That's what it is. It doesn't really represent reality. So what they do is they set a low bar. And the reason why they set this low bar is because for the next 6 years, they want to show increasing test scores. You see this in Texas, too. Every single testing regime, they set a low bar, fail most of the kids. And then because they want to politically be able to show an increasing trend line upwards. You see this with the TOS, the tax, and then now the STAR. And that's really what folks don't realize. The politicians are now using educational policy as political football. And testing and accountability has become political and arbitrary.
Yes, and this is, and for me as an educational psychologist, because assessment is part of my field, it's very galling. And this is just what happened in New York State 10 years ago when Mayor Bloomberg claimed that the children were doing better and better in the schools under him because they made the tests, they manipulated the scores. So at this point, these test scores They're not valid for evaluating teachers because the data shows about 10 to 14% of the child's achievement score might be influenced by the teacher and the rest by outside factors, like the kid's ability and interest and background.
Right.
But this manipulation really upsets the parents.
But let me ask, I mean, because, you know, different...
Can I poke in here?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Well, I think it's important to say this because it's really relevant to D.C. So recently they released a study maybe 2 weeks ago saying that teacher evaluation using test scores is actually positive for schools, and they use D.C. as an example.
Who's
now,
that?
The issue is, it was a recent study out of Stanford, Thomas D. And so, but we know from Linda Darling Hammond's work and Ed Hartel's work that 70% of teachers bounce between great teachers, not so great teachers when you use test scores to evaluate the success, because there's a lot of things that happen in kids' lives, and as a psychometrician, you probably know this, lots of things that happen in kids' lives that is not related to the teacher. And so what happens is you have a little statistical error that's not attributable to the teacher, and that's why these models are unstable.
And
so the problem is
and the American Statistical Association, which has no dog in this fight, has said that these cannot. They are not only that they're not reliable, the scores bounce around, but they're not valid. The teacher has very little input into the child's school.
Julian, I was at a conference this past Saturday that was held by the Washington Teachers Union, and Linda Darling Hammond said exactly what you just said. She went through the presentation that was totally enlightening to me, and I'm like, oh my goodness. You know, this is really, you know, I mean, it's much worse than what I had imagined. It's ridiculous. Some of the things, some of the games that the policymakers are playing with education.
Yeah. That's right. And, I was trained by Linda Darling Hammond at Stanford, so that might explain a few things. But the thing is that there is that piece. So even an issue with research is there's always what is that sort of unintended consequence policy. And so what they're saying is that you should fire teachers and bring in these new young teachers. But if the new young teachers you bring in are drill and kill and test prepping, then that's going to bias the research results. Because if you're bringing in teachers that are focused on test scores, and what do test scores actually represent? Do they represent success in our society? So one of the things I think ESSA will allow us to do is measure schools by a variety of other factors, including climate, including school discipline, because we need to judge our schools not just based on tests, because what's happened is it's perverted what's happening in schools in D.C. and elsewhere. And so when we use a dashboard of data that has a variety of different measurements, now schools are able to focus on the things that matter. I'm going to be honest with folks, test scores don't really matter. What really matters is student success.
Right.
We want students to be ready for career and ready for college, and that is also not a test score. That's what John King was pressing in New York, is this redefinition of what college readiness is based on test score, based on the SAT, PSAT.
And we could mention that the SAT is not a good predictor of success in college. All the data for years and years has shown that.
You know, one of the things that was talked about basically a theme at this conference, I mean, looking at individualizing assessment, you know, not having a one-size-fits-all assessment. You know, looking at, okay, where's this student at this point, and at the end of the year, where are they? Looking at multiple measures outside of test scores and trying to determine the progress of students and how effective teachers are when they talk about value add.
That's right. And if you
New
think
York
so,
State,
I
we
actually
have a consortium of schools that have been allowed to use research reports and in-depth projects for assessment instead of standardized tests. I was amazed to go to a school in a poverty-stricken area that takes in kids that were not succeeding in other schools. I was invited to sit in on these students were presenting their reports, and they had, I think, two teachers, two students, and two professionals in the field. It was a history class, and there was some sort of historian, and I was invited to come in just as an education professor and we had 20 minutes to read their report, and then they answered questions on it. I looked
right.
at the report with a formal bibliography and listened to their presentation and begged them to think of enrolling at Hunter College.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When you have a chance to develop an idea in depth, you get to learn to think for yourself.
Right. Yep.
It's very different from a multiple choice test.
So the thing is, let's talk about this DC evaluation again. So they use 50 questions. So these tests on average have 50 questions. And so these 50 questions are supposed to judge a year's worth of learning for a particular kid. 50 questions on a standardized exam. And so when they talk about, it increased learning by 3 months of learning, often what you're talking about is 2 or 3 questions on a particular test is 3 months of learning, right?
And if what you're doing is test prep, then the sample on the questions is not representing classroom learning.
And excuse me, I'm going to interrupt here for a second because something has been kind of burning here during this conversation. This is Virginia Spatz, by the way, in case people didn't hear me before. I wanted to ask a kind of shift things and ask about the school as a part of a neighborhood and a society and a culture instead of just a place that we, you know, this whole idea of success. If you are a citizen of your neighborhood when you are 8 or 13 or 16, that's also important. Mm-hmm. And we're, and I don't specifically see that as a measure on your report card. And I wonder how can we get back to thinking about our schools as integrated into the neighborhood and not this factory.
Okay, let
said, giving the community a larger role and relating more directly to community organizations is important. Although the financing has to be from the state or a broader unit because we have our school districts warded off to separate the rich kids from the poor kids, and we need money.
Yeah.
From everybody or the poor kids, go down the tube.
Let's let Dr. Holly.
Reformers advocating for that.
Let's let Dr. Holly, because we're running out of time.
I'll make it fast. So first, I want to wrap up the other conversation, which is that what the professor was talking about is community-based assessment of students relative to top-down privatized assessment of students by Pearson and others. We have examples of how communities can assess kids using qualitative and quantitative measures. That's what we're talking about. That's the alternative. So then on the community-based approaches, the hot conversation right now is about community schools. And this actually goes back to Detroit and earlier in the 60s, where you have these community schools that are beacons in the community, and we also have the wraparound services to meet the needs of kids in poverty. Because it's not poverty that causes low test scores. It's the instability in kids' lives, the things that happen to them, that they're not prepared to do the work when they arrive at school on any particular day because the things that are happening in their lives. Now, the alternative vision to community schools is what you see in New Orleans, where black parents have to put their kids on the buses at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. Mm. And because of school choice, they have to take these buses for 2 hours all the way across town because they're not allowed to go to schools in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
All those schools have been closed, or they have restrictive admissions policies, so only certain kids can go to them, or they're private schools that have tuition attached to them, and therefore they're not allowed. Karen Royal talks about how there was 5 schools in her neighborhood, and her kid couldn't go to any of them.
Yeah.
He had to go all the way across town. And then those black kids don't show up until 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night. So for those of you that have kids, basically those parents spend just a few hours with their kids every single day. That's the vision that market-based reformers have for your kids and have for black kids and for Latino kids, which is that this market-based reform, they have everything they want in New Orleans, and those kids are on buses across town in schools that are not neighborhood-based, that are not community-based. And so I think one of the other things in the SSA is there is support for community-based schools, wraparound services, and making schools the beacons of community like they have been instead of this market-based approach which separates families from their children.
I'm going to give Rosalie an opportunity. We have to end in the next minute and a half. But I just want to say Karen is a personal friend as well as a friend of the show. She does wonderful work down in New Orleans. Rosalie, I wanted to give you an opportunity to chime in because
Okay, I'm going to make it real short. The parents rebelled and opted out in great numbers this year. The governor looked at these low scores and said the teachers are doing a terrible job and set up a punitive evaluation system. When he saw the number of opt-outs, was not willing to go along with a change in the legislation that he had pushed through, but set a moratorium in order to keep the parents from realizing that there was, in others, it made the appearance of change, not the substance of change. And it's not clear whether the people working for opt-out will be able to fight this or not. In New York City, the administration is backing the tests and putting a lot of pressure on the principals and the individual parents. Mm-hmm. Other parts of the state, it's not as bad.
Okay.
One of the things John King did, in addition to fervently supporting these horrible policies, he offended so many people that he really encouraged the opt-out.
Yeah.
And that part of it is kind of interesting, too. Now, the change that's more significant is King's buddy Merrill Tisch has resigned from the Board of Regents, and we're hoping to replace her with a career educator, Betty Rosa, who has been viewing education the way we do, that it should be for children, not a revenue stream for business.
Okay. Rosalie, I'm going to have to ask you to pause because sure. I have something that I wanted to make sure I got in, thanks to Denisha Jones, who sent this to me.
Yes,
Jeremy Dudley. We're gonna go to that now. Ron is gonna cue that up right now. We're gonna go to that, and hopefully we'll have about a minute just to have a comment after that.
Lovely.
Dudley, aka Origin, January 2016. They're sick of all these tests like opt out, opt out. Sick of all this mess like opt out, opt out. Get rid of all the stress. Opt out. I see it on my feed. Opt out. They won't be deceived. Opt out. These reforms we don't need. Opt out. It's January 2016, and you should know that the opt-out movement will continue to grow. And it's spread from coast to coast just like some wildfire. It's time to stop this madness, is what they desire. More sick outs in Detroit, it's a call to distress. Crumbling buildings exposed, take a look at the mess. And the students walk out to stand up for the right to equality. Education, keep an eye on that fight. In Atlanta public schools, they fight a plan to turn around. They're shouting with conviction, APS will not go down. Friedrichs versus the CTA, that's bad news. If she wins, the ripple effect means that many lose. In Fort Worth, they're giving more recess than it's successful. Counterbalancing the fact that school has gotten stressful. In Louisiana, the super can't get it right. So they started a petition, replace John White. In Compton, students want trauma counseling too. A right to equal education is the reason they've sued. Alabama solving shortages by lowering the bar. No certification needed, keep this on your radar. Out of court in Nevada, public school parents won. An injunction has been granted, but the fight is not done. The national PTA won't opt out. We know who their donors are, we see what they're about. Chris Christie in New Jersey wants more privatization. Support in smoke and mirrors, not public education. Indiana is a mess, our step is worthless. $65 million for what? A bad test. In Chicago, where the fight is far from over, they can now be facing a state takeover. And if the state takes over, they'll void their contracts and students will lose. Please don't ignore facts. In New York, many received an erroneous score. Another problem with the system we don't need anymore. The announcement has been made this summer for all who fight. July 8th through 10th in D.C., we unite. That's right, July 8th through 10th, Washington, D.C. Save Our Schools Coalition, United Opt Out, Badass Teacher Association, NPE, and many more. They're sick of all these tests like opt out. Sick of all this mess like opt out. Get rid of all the stress. Opt out. I see it on my feed. Opt out. They won't be deceived. Opt out. These reforms we don't need. Opt out.
All right. You know, I'm just say quickly, I might have to change my theme song to that. That I love it. I want to give you the opportunity to make a comment. I'm sorry, what was that, Julian?
I said that was hot, you know. So I'm the professor that you'll see driving down on his Jeep, you know, rocking the hip hop. So that was really hot. Somebody needs to tweet at Chuck D. You know, a lot of people don't know this about me, but before I blog on Cloaking Inequity, I'll listen to Public Enemy, for those of you that know something about that. And he has a really good song that says, those who know who. And so, and I think that that song applies perfectly to this conversation, which is that we know who's really behind a lot of this stuff and why they're doing this. And even though they try to wrap it in civil rights themes, we know what they're really up to. And I'm just going to say that song was hot. So I got to get that MP3.
All right. That's going to have to do it. Sorry, Rosalie. I was hoping to have an opportunity to give you, but you've heard the song before. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Great.
Yes.
So we're going to have to end there, Rosalie. I'm sorry. We're just plumb run out of time. I want to thank you though, Rosalie, friend of Save Our Schools, for joining us. I want to thank Dr. Julian Heilig, who is a professor, blogger, on-air, print education contributor, education chair of California NAACP, for joining us. Consider yourself a friend of the show, Julian. I want you to come back. Want you to come back anytime and check out our blog, educationtownhall.org, and we'll link up in cyberspace. Folks, I want to wish you a wonderful week until next Thursday at 11 a.m. here on the Education Town Hall. For Ron Pinchback, our engineer, our feature reporter, Virginia Spatz, this is your humble servant and host, Thomas Byrd. Peace.
Dudley, a.k.a. Origin. January 2016. They're sick of all these tests like opt out, opt out. Sick of all this mess like opt out, opt out. Get rid of all the stress. Opt out, opt out, opt out, opt out.
The media, we visited the sites, we have shown the media the real situation so that everyone, the workers, the fans club, and the general public should know what's going on in Qatar, what should know the slavery that is happening in Qatar, and FIFA is responsible for it.
Tell us about the migrant workers in Qatar. You've been there a number of